Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Williams versus Patton.
Okay, please, the court. Mr. Gary McConnell will present oral argument for petitioner. Mr. McConnell has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel for respondent. I believe that I can start by saying that there is one point that the Court of Appeals majority and I agreed upon in this particular case, and that is that this case presents a matter of first impression as to whether or not a custodial, non-custodial parent or parents can validly enter into a compromise and settlement agreement of past due, accrued, and unpaid child support. That, of course, is the issue that's presented to this court. This is not a case, I want to make clear, that involves any attempt on the part of the parents of a minor child to modify future support for that child without court approval. I believe that the case law of this state and Section 14.08 of the Texas Family Code prohibits that result. And I'm not here before you today arguing that particular point, and I think my brief makes that clear. Now, the case law in the sister states that I've quoted in my brief generally run along the lines of where there has been some dispute between the parents of a child, which has resulted in perhaps mother, the custodial parent, telling father, the non-custodial parent, look, I don't want you to see the child anymore. I'll give up child support if you'll give up visitation. Now, there have been a number of cases across the country that have held that that's valid under certain circumstances.
Counsel, your client would not be in this predicament if the court order itself had been modified at the time this agreement was entered into.
I assume you're referring, Your Honor, to the court order concerning the past due arrearages.
That's correct.
That's certainly correct. That's what we're here about.
And why didn't that happen?
Because, in my opinion, at the time that this transaction was entered into, it wasn't necessary.
So basically you're asking us to hold that if parties make a contract and by contract modify a court order.
No, I'm not asking you to do that at all. What I am asking you to do is to hold that there is no meaningful difference between accrued unpaid arrearages as part of a final judgment than any other judgment that awards to a party a recovery. And that party has the right to compromise or settle that claim against the other party at any time.
You're saying that child support orders are an order to pay child support, and unpaid child support is merely a debt just like any other commercial debt.
If you'll excuse my expression, Your Honor, I think that's a minefield that this court has walked around very carefully in the past. I don't think that the characterization of the obligation as a debt is necessary to the outcome of this case. But if you want my opinion, yes, it's a debt. I think under any reasonable construction, it's got to be a debt. But obviously, if it's a debt, then constitutional questions arise concerning the enforcement of that debt by contempt. And that's why this court has very carefully disclaimed in past opinions, including Adair versus Martin, Huff versus Huff, and I think it was Brimhall versus Smith, or Smith versus Brimhall, that this court disapproved of any characterization of unpaid child support as a debt for that reason.
Let's say assume that the managing conservator enters into an agreement like this, but then chooses to apply for AFDC and food stamps, which in effect assigns her right to recover child support to the Attorney General, who then is the party seeking to enforce the child support obligation. Would her contract effectively waive the child's rights to receive child support and be a bar to that lawsuit?
Well, I believe Your Honor has added a dimension to a case that is not that complicated, but let me say this. I believe that this court can very well hold, and there have been other cases decided across the country, that the custodial parent under circumstances such as that cannot validly waive her claim against the non-custodial parent for support if it's going to affect a third-party provider, such as public assistance, AFDC, as you say, to that child. I would say that under those circumstances, it would require the joining or the agreement of, in this case, the Attorney General's office before such an agreement can be made. However, I don't think that it stops or prevents there being a settlement agreement reached as to that past due support. It just requires the agreement of another party. Now, as I said...
Did Mr. Williams pay the $2,850?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. That's not disputed. He also, as part of the consideration for the settlement agreement, agreed to increase his child support substantially, upwards of three times what he had previously been ordered to pay.
Does the record reflect whether that was a way of paying out the arrearage or not?
I believe that the record shows that it was not. Now, the dissent takes that tack in the in reasoning through a little bit in her opinion. However, since I was the party involved, or I was the attorney representing Mr. Williams at the time, and I think it's on the record where that matter was brought out in the trial of this case, there was no understanding that this was going to be the means to pay out any excess or the difference between the $2,850 and the accrued support. The agreement was that she would accept $2,850, lump sum, and the promise and agreement on the part of Mr. Williams to agree to the higher support.
You've already conceded that no agreement could be made to decrease. It would not be binding to make an agreement to decrease future child support, to make it less than the court order.
I think that's established by the state's law.
Is, on the other hand, this deal you made, would it be binding, would an agreement to voluntarily increase child support be binding in the absence of court approval?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe it would. I don't think the parties can, under this state's jurisprudence, bind the court to any modification of future support.
So the argument you just made is really gratuitous. I mean, you said just a moment ago, yes, we compromised $7,928.50, but he agreed to triple the child support in the future. But that's not really consideration. That's just a gratuitous offer.
I disagree with that analysis, Your Honor, simply for this reason, is that he was not compelled. There was no reason for him to enter into that agreement. And this was an agreement entered into, and then approval was sought from the court as was required. Now,
Okay. Maybe
I misled you in my answer. I didn't mean to imply
right,
that the parties...
Well, I missed... The parties went and got approval for that traveling.
Yes, sir, and that's in the record. The approval was obtained, and his obligation to pay the increased child support was memorialized in a written order signed by the trial court.
Counsel, the settlement in 1985 was essentially for 25 cents on the dollar in unpaid child support, isn't it?
I don't recall. I think it's a little more than that, Your Honor, but I wouldn't quibble with
well,
it was 25 or 30 cents.
Take. So basically, Ms. Williams or Ms. Patton forgave let's say 75% approximately of the unpaid accrued child support obligation. The court could not do that. The court could not enter a judgment forgiving 75% of the child support that had been due over the 11 years of the obligation, could it?
I think you've asked me two questions, Your Honor, if I may.
Sure.
First, I don't agree that that's all the consideration that was paid for her agreement. Second, I do agree that the court could not modify this. However, that's not relevant to this particular case because in any civil setting where a judgment is involved, whether it's for money, performance, or any type of judgment, the parties always have the right to compromise and settle that dispute. Under the rules of civil procedure, though, I think it's Rule 329, it's in my brief, the court, under normal civil procedure for cases which judgments have been entered, lacks that power as well. So why, if a normal judgment cannot be compromised by non-divorce related or non-family related matters, why should that fact alone be dispositive of this particular case? Because it just simply ratifies or reaffirms the fact that no court without the approval of the parties can modify an existing judgment.
Who is protecting the best interests of the child here?
Well, the best interests of the child, I think, were protected from the standpoint of entry with approval into the increased child support under the order modifying the
priority. Is that necessary then for your position?
No, sir. I was getting ready to say that. I don't think that's relevant to this proceeding because I think the matter of past child support but is a matter that involves the former spouses and not those concerning the best interest of the child, for the reason that the funds are already advanced for the benefit of that child. Whether you use a debtor theory or a trust theory, it becomes an obligation for the custodial parent, who can forgive, release, or compromise that under
future
general rule.
Future payments aren't, but past payments that have been missed are.
That's exactly right. And that, I believe, is the majority opinion that I've recited in my case that was set out by the Idaho Supreme Court in the Anderson versus Anderson case.
Counsel, isn't family law a very serious situation?
I don't disagree with that, John.
isn't the payment of child support one that is very troublesome to this whole country at this time?
I believe that it is, Your Honor.
And you understand that Congress is considering a law that would withhold child support from the payor's check, just as it does his federal withholding and his Social Security.
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. I would accept that as being the case.
And would you, what about the point that, your point is the parties can make an agreement? But would they also be able to make an agreement regarding a change of custody or a change of visitation that would be binding on the court?
No, Your Honor, not as to any enforceable agreement. I think that there are casual or informal agreements made all the time between the parties, but if one party decides they're going to fight it, it's not enforceable if they're trying to use an agreement as to change of custody. I think that's made clear by Section 14.08, because that involves a change as to future status of the child, which once again goes back to what I've said about future support. That involves a change in the future status, i.e. the support for necessaries for that child.
Oh, let me ask about some there are very few analogous situations in the law, but workers' compensation cases, at least under the old law, settlements had to be approved by the court. Are you aware of any case law that a settlement that called for monthly payments could later be compromised by a workers' compensation claimant and the carrier without any court approval? Is there any law on that?
I'm not aware of it, Your Honor. To tell you the truth, I hadn't thought about that analogy, but I would submit that analogy would be a little bit different from this case, because that, I think, is a statutorily declared requirement that the trial court approve any compromised settlement agreement. We don't have such a statutorily required requirement in this case as to the past due child support, although the court of appeals...
Well, because let's suppose the insurance company is in some financial trouble, which is not unheard of.
Yes,
and it goes to a compensation claimant and says, we owe you $280 a week. We're a little low on money, but we missed some payments, but we'll pay you lump sum that comes up to $200 a week or something. I mean, can that be done without going back to the court or not?
I doubt it, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be precisely analogous to this?
No, I don't think so. Once again, I fall back on the fact that the workers' compensation statute requires, in order to be enforceable, that the CSA be approved by the trial court or the IAB if it's not gotten into what used to be the IAB before it got into the trial court.
Well, it's a reinforceable child support, just totally on a voluntary contract between parents?
As to the past due accrued arrearages,
I'm talking about as to the amount. I mean, there's nothing in the law about the CSA, it's about past due. I mean, that's totally silent on that. It's merely...
I'll have to defer on that, Your Honor. I'm not aware that there was a distinction. I just know from past experience that there has been a requirement that CSAs be approved. Now, whether or not that can be modified...
And isn't there a requirement that child support be approved?
Yes, sir. That's exactly correct. That may very well be true. I'm not aware of any case law that is held that as far as any accrued, unpaid payments due under a compromise settlement agreement, whether that could be voluntarily, consensually disposed of without court approval. I don't know.
Counsel, you said that CSA can be voluntarily agreed to between the parties. Is that correct?
Well, I think I was misunderstanding what His Honor was trying to point out. What I'm saying is that a compromise settlement agreement between the worker and the insurance company, if it's made at the point where the IAB still had jurisdiction or the Workers' Compensation Commission, would have to be approved by that commission statutorily. As to any payments, in his example, where the insurance company is in trouble and there may be some defaults and payments under the compromise settlement agreement, whether there could be a valid, assuming adequate consideration is given, compromise of those past due payments. I don't know. I don't recall ever seeing a case on that.
If the parties voluntarily agreed to increase the child support by 25% and this were not done, would the party who did not receive the additional 25% have the power of contempt?
I wouldn't think so, Your Honor, because once again, to be able to enforce an agreement concerning future support, whether it's increase or decrease, I believe that 1408 and case law says you're going to have to get the trial court to approve it.
Isn't it the wise posture to always have any change or modification in the child support agreement put in a court order?
I don't know that I'm capable of telling this court what's wise, Your Honor. I think it would obviously be safe had I known 5 years ago or 6 years ago I was going to be up here arguing this point. I would have run over and had the judge approve it as part of the approval of the increase in support, because obviously that would have been much less expensive and much better for my client. However, at the time, I simply didn't see it as being a problem. I now realize I was mistaken.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Lynette Terry will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, my name is Lynette Terry and I represent the respondent, Sherry Patton, in this appeal. This case presents the question of whether parents of a minor child can contract away court-imposed duties. Our position is that they cannot. This state has set the policy through case law and statute that parents cannot, by agreement, without court approval, change or modify court orders.
Do you agree that if the parties have gone to court and got the judgment for the arrearages by the trial court, that they could have compromised that judgment?
Your Honor, I agree that if the parties had gone to court and got a judgment for the $9,885 that was owed, that later Mrs. Patton could have compromised that judgment.
What's the difference?
The difference is that the full amount, the difference is that she had a motion for contempt filed. And I don't believe that could be compromised.
You can't compromise, you can't give up a motion for contempt?
I don't believe that in a motion for contempt, the parties after the court finds the contempt can compromise the amount of money that's owed.
Well, let me see if I understand. So if there's a motion for contempt filed at the same time that there's a request for reducing the amount of arrearage to judgment, that if that judgment is rendered, you can't compromise that judgment?
Your Honor, she might be able to compromise the judgment. I agree that she might be able to compromise that judgment.
So what difference, since it's perfectly liquidated in most instances, there might be a dispute about whether this payment was made or that payment, but since it's mostly liquidated and you know what it is, why can't the parties compromise it before judgment as opposed to after judgment?
Because Section 14.41D does not allow the court to reduce or modify the arrearage. And if the court cannot do it, they could not approve an agreement of the parties that does it.
So they can't go in and agree to it, the court can't do it, but if the court does render judgment for the whole amount, then they can do whatever they want to with it. Does that strike you as making much sense?
No, sir. The remedy of choice would be the contempt.
Well, unless you want to compromise, which you might want to do. Parties do want to do that sometimes.
Yes.
So they could have this $9,885, and the husband say, well, look, honey, I'll pay you $10,000, but I can't pay you $9,885. And the wife may be perfectly glad to get $7,000, but she can't take it and he can't give it. That's where they are.
Yes.
pay the whole thing or go to jail.
Well, it's up to the wife to enforce that judgment, to execute on that judgment. After the court has reduced it to a final judgment, and if the wife wants to execute and she executes for less than that judgment and then releases him, she can do that, I believe.
She can enter a release?
After the court has reduced it to judgment.
Oh, okay. No, but not.
Just to be clear, Amy moved out of her mother's house about 18 months before she turned 18.
Yes, sir.
And she stayed with her father a few months and then moved out of his house.
That's right.
And did not stay with either parent for several months until she turned 18.
That's right.
Does the courts have the resources to go through the drill that you just outlined? And is that something we should be concerned about? Is courts having to enter extra judgments or hold contempt hearings when there's a possibility that compromises could be reached that reach the same result as might be reached after the court had done all of its work?
That could be a possibility, Your Honor, but then you would find custodial parents taking less than what they were entitled to. And you would find non-custodial parents holding out or not abiding by court orders in hopes of, at a later time, reducing their obligation by 25 cents on the dollar.
But, if the courts are not clogged with signing judgments, and enforcing contempts that are later going to be compromised, won't the courts have more time on custodial parents who do not want to compromise, more time to hear their contempts timely? There's nothing that obligates anybody to make such a compromise. You can enforce to the letter of the law and get however much money is actually there up to the amount that has previously been ordered for child support.
Yes,
I'm not sure I see where the coercion doesn't come in unless the courts are so clogged up that, or the possessory conservator is so clever at hiding assets that the legal processes aren't going to be effective. As long as the legal processes are effective, the compromise should be a purely voluntary thing.
Or if the custodial parent has not received child support for 8 years, as in this case, and once the motion to modify or motion for contempt or enforcement is filed, and the non-custodial parent says, well, here is $3,000 rather than $9,000, that sounds real good to a custodial parent who has not received anything for 8 years. So,
had she totally slept on her rights, or had she not been able to find the father, or what was... I mean, how come she didn't receive anything for 8 years? What did she do to try to remedy that situation?
I believe that there was a contempt filed prior, Your Honor, with no service. I believe that the father, in this case, was a truck driver for a while. And I do not know. I was not the lawyer at the time of the settlement and release agreement, nor the prior contempt.
During part of this period for which she seeks to recover the arrearage of support, Amy was not living with either one of her parents. Is that true?
Yes, Your Honor. the statement of facts reflected, though, that my client was paying for school clothes, other necessities, money that the child needed, and that was proved up at the trial court level. And that my client was the only one providing the child with any type of financial help.
Counsel, do you consider this agreement to be strictly voluntary in the sense that Ms. Patton had not received any child support for a period of about 8 years from Mr. Williams, and she was faced with the prospect of getting something or perhaps nothing?
Yes, sir. That, I don't believe that it was completely voluntary.
Is there an element of economic coercion involved?
I believe so, Your Honor. The other thing for the court's consideration is that along with the motion for contempt that was filed there was a motion to modify to increase child support. And as Mr. McConnell had mentioned earlier, child support was almost tripled. Well, child support is supposed to be based on that parent's ability to pay to support their child. Now, if Mr. Williams had the ability to pay $325 or $350 at the time of the settlement and release, then he also had the ability to pay the arrearage.
He agreed to it.
Yes, sir, he agreed to it. So in essence, Mr. Williams was saying, I'll pay you $2,800 cash right now, and then I will increase your $121 a month to $350, which the court would probably order anyway.
Counsel, is there any evidence in the record of what Mr. Williams' income was at the time the settlement agreement was entered into?
Your Honor, in the record, Mr. Williams failed to remember how much he made at that time and the year prior to our hearing.
So you can't tell us whether or not the application of the child support guidelines promulgated would, in fact, result in a child support obligation of that same amount or less or more?
No, sir, I cannot tell you that.
Well, could they address it this way? Look, we want to settle this. We can't settle it because the Supreme Court's ruled in Williams versus Patton that you can't do it this way. So what we'll do is we'll go get a judgment for it for the arrearage. Then you release the judgment. Then we'll go to the court and we'll agree to an increased child support, and I'll give you $2,850. Could they do it that way?
Your Honor, I think that by the code, they could do it that way. I think that if they do it that way, the custodial parent that is owed that money gives up more than they should. If a remedy or if that non-custodial, that custodial parent's remedy is contempt, then the judgment is secondary. That's a secondary remedy. And if you take a judgment, the judgment is only good if that person has something to execute on. So I think that by our code, on the provision in 14.40D and 14.41D, which this case is meant to interpret, what our code is telling us is that if we allow reductions or modifications in child support arrearages, then we are not looking after the best interest of the child.
Counsel, if parties at the time of divorce come in and tell the judge, we've agreed on everything, we've divided up the property, Mama's going to take the child, be managing conservator, Pop will be possessory conservator, but Judge, we've agreed that there will be no child support obligation. We want you to approve that agreement. Is the court obligated in looking out for the best interest of the child to accept that agreement or to reject that agreement and order child support?
I think that the court at that point acts as a sort of guardian ad litem and has to look at the facts surrounding that. If the court believes that the party, the non-custodial parent, is capable of paying that child support, then I believe that the court has to send the parties back to rework their agreement as our code states. I believe it's in 1406A.
As a matter of fact, the reason we're here today, though, is that Mr. Williams ceased paying the $350 that he had agreed to pay.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
We're not here because Ms. Patton decided that was an inadequate settlement of that earlier support. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor. If Mr. Williams had completed his agreement and continued to pay the $350 until Amy reached 18, she would not have brought her motion to enforce.
But she could have.
Yes, sir, she could have.
She might not have, but she could.
And she did not, Your Honor, until Amy moved out of his home and she again was financially responsible for herself, where
so
Mr. Williams
said,
would
well,
not have.
Well, you owe me the $350, but by the way, you also owe me that back there that we never did really get settled.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's the effect of her.
Yes, sir.
But under your view of the case, He could have paid the $350 right up to the end of his agreement, and she could still have sued him for the arrearage.
Yes, sir. Because, Your Honor, at that point, there was still $7,000 in arrearages that he had not paid and that were not accounted for. This court has always taken the position, I believe, that child support is a duty, and that duty is verified by the court order to pay child support. That court order is what makes non-custodial parents, sadly enough, take care of their children. If this court changes that, then the problems we have with collection of child support could become even greater.
That's not entirely correct statement, is it, counsel? Court order does not make people pay child support because, in fact, only about 15% of the child support ordered in this state is actually paid on time and in full. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir. I don't know the percentage, Your Honor. I know that with the enforcement provisions now in the code, I have noticed that the child support collection in our county has increased.
At the time Ms. Patton received this lump sum payment, did she sign any kind of release on the prior child support that where it was due at that time?
Just the release, Your Honor, that's before the court, the release and settlement agreement.
Did that purport to release this prior amount that is now the subject of this suit?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, it did. From 1977 to 1985.
So, in effect, she released him for that, but then she had second thoughts about it because he did not carry out what she considered the rest of the agreement.
She didn't have second thoughts, Your Honor. If he was not going to abide by that settlement and release agreement whereby he agreed to pay her the $350 until Amy reached 18, then she felt she did not have to abide by the release agreement releasing him from the $7,000 in arrearages.
Any other questions?
Basically, it was an amicable agreement enforceable by no one. Compliance was purely voluntary on the part of both. She could have taken that agreement and still gone and filed a contempt on it.
Yes, sir.
It was unenforceable by the courts as an agreement until it was reduced to judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, in fact, there was only an agreement to get along, and if we don't get along, there is no agreement.
In essence, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Gary McConnell will present rebuttal for petition.
Let me address one thing that just came up about the failing, Mr. Williams' failure to pay the $350 or whatever the amount was at the time of that default. I don't think that's disputed. It resulted from a change in circumstances, but obviously he had no right to withhold that until he had that adjudicated by the court. But the important thing that you must remember is the court ordered him to pay everything that he was obligated to pay under the modified order, including the $350 a month. But the court did not order Mrs. Patton to pay what she had agreed to do back in 1986. So it's just not a one-sided deal from the standpoint of what he was trying to do. It actually resulted in her having the benefit of all of the payments at the increased level that he was ordered to pay by agreement, and the $2,850 as well, and the agreement to pay the increased support. Now, Your Honor, you mentioned something about an element of economic coercion. I want to make sure that you have a complete understanding of the facts in this case. Mrs. Patton, I think her name was Bailey at that time, and this is in the record, had filed a motion, I think, to confirm arrearages, and she may have coupled that with a motion for contempt in either 1985 or 1986, wherein she sought accrued unpaid arrearages from 1974, about a year after they had been divorced, or two. She had not done anything, and this is in the record, to collect that money for almost 12 years. And in fact, part of what she sought to recover in that initial case was barred by limitations, even under the 10-year statute. That was one of the defenses asserted against her action. There were other affirmative defenses asserted, including voluntary relinquishment on her part of the child for periods in excess of the court-ordered possession, as well as payment of support in excess of that ordered by the court. So this was not, in addition, she had counsel representing her throughout that particular period when that agreement was reached. So I don't think there's an element of economic coercion. There was no showing that Mr. Williams could not have paid more or that she demanded more than he did. That's not in the record.
Counsel, we'll be making a rule, though, that doesn't necessarily just apply to this case, but applies to all similar cases. And haven't you seen in your experience situations where the relationship between the managing conservator and the possessory conservator is so difficult that the managing conservator, the mother typically, who has the right to receive child support for the benefit of the child, gives up and does not pursue the collection of child support because the possessory conservator makes life for the child and her so miserable that she gives up and tries to get by the best she can.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That
I've seen it from both sides.
Sure.
I've also seen settlements entered into by injured workers with insurance companies after they won a judgment against them because the injured worker didn't have the financial wherewithal to withstand the appeals process. So people compromise and settle obligations for economic reasons every day.
The injured worker is settling his or her claim and not a third party's, a minor child.
Well, no, I disagree with that, Your Honor. That's characterizing the support after it's accrued as being an obligation that's owing to the child.
Who's the support for the benefit of?
The support that's ordered to be paid is for the benefit of the child, until the time period is passed for which the support was ordered to be paid. Presumably, absent the considerations that you and I talked about earlier of having a third-party provider involved, presumably the custodial parent has advanced the necessary funds for rent, food, and other necessaries of life. And under either theory, whether it's a direct debtor-creditor obligation or a trust fund obligation, the cause of action that would arise from that set of circumstances belongs to the custodial parent, not to the child, because the child's already been provided for. So that is an important distinction.
Or not provided for is the case.
Well, there's no evidence in this case, obviously, that the child wasn't provided for. I think that clearly any time an agreement is sought to be enforced and the party against whom that agreement is sought to be enforced can show evidence of fraud, economic coercion beyond that permitted, if you will, by law, as well as any other acts that make it clear that there is an involuntary action entering that agreement, that's something that the court ought to take into consideration as in any agreement. Because if any party goes into court seeking to enforce an agreement that was obtained or procured by fraud, overreaching, coercion, duress, and the like, that agreement ought not to be enforced. And the same thing would apply in this case.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second cause, and the court will now take another brief recess.
Now, here's the meeting, Brian.